December 2nd, 2001, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 48, The Engagement and Its Fallout. Okay, well, I decided to go on to leave off on the biographies because as one member of the class said, we were going around in circles. But because you keep end up sort of retelling the same history. So I thought we've covered two of the principal characters, and I thought we'd move along. And we may come back to some of them later as need be. So I'd like to pick up then the chronological history, and we're going to still overlap a little bit of the first part, just by a little bit. And that is, we're going to start with the engagement. The reason is the engagement seems to be the central to much of what happened after in the succeeding years. You can see almost everything seems to hinge one way or another on things that happen after the engagement, when it failed and so on. So, okay, so we'll start then in November 1647. The king had escaped and he fled to Carisbrooke Castle on the Isle of Wight. And he signed this agreement document called the Engagement with a party of Scots nobility, Loudoun, Lauderdale, and Lanark. Lauderdale had actually been one of the Westminster commissioners, one of the lay members of the Westminster Assembly. When he was a youth, he was a Covenanter, and then after a time, he became a Royalist, and he later led the persecution against the Covenanters. He was the king's, basically the governor of Scotland, I guess, for the king. Lauderdale. Yeah. So. Okay, well, to some degree, they... You know, it was a little hard to say for sure who they represented, but as you can see, when they can't come back to Scotland, they were able to get most of the peers of the Scottish realm to go along with the engagement, all but maybe 8 or 9 or 10, something like that. The terms were that the king would have both the English and Scottish parliaments affirm the solemn league and covenant, providing that none who is unwilling shall be constrained to take it. The king would establish Presbyterian church government in England for 3 years, and afterwards, he would continue the Westminster Assembly, and then afterwards he would, with some consultation from the Assembly, the king and the parliament would determine how to establish church government. He would suppress the opinions and practices of anti-Trinitarians, Anabaptists, Antinomians, Arminians, Familists, Brownists, Separatists, Independents, Libertines, and Seekers. Oliver Cromwell apparently being a Seeker. And the Scots army would restore to the king, would restore the king to power. To our modern ears, you know, this, you know, if you've read the history and so on, this might not seem like, you know, too bad of a solution. You know, it's sort of a compromise between all the parties. It seems to follow a reasonable middle road and so on. Indeed, that might have seemed that way to many, many of the Scots. But the Church of Scotland did not see it as a reasonable compromise. Rather, they saw it as a violation of the Solemn League and Covenant. In particular, it seems to it violates Clause 6 by dividing two of the main parties, the English and Scottish parliaments. They took an oath to, we shall also, according to our places and callings in this common cause of religion, liberty, and peace of the kingdoms, assist and defend all those that enter into this league and covenant in the maintaining and pursuing thereof, and shall not suffer ourselves directly or indirectly by whatsoever combination, persuasion, or terror, to be divided or withdrawn from this blessed union and conjunction, whether to make defection to the contrary part or to give ourselves to a detestable indifference or neutrality in this cause. Anyways, it goes on from there. But basically that they were accepting, in a sense, a separate peace and were dividing off from the English Parliament, or would have been. It also leaves open the government, the church government in England, which was part of the terms in Article 1 or Clause 1, that we shall sincerely and really and constantly, through the grace of God, endeavor in our several places and callings the preservation of the Reformed religion in the Church of Scotland, in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government against our common enemies, the reformation of religion in the kingdoms of England and Ireland. This is according to the example of the best Reformed churches. So again, this, you know, given the king's temper, him promising that he would establish Presbyterian church government for 3 years and then he would see, you know, that was not really much of a promise. I mean, it was a little bone, but not much more than that. Finally, it leaves open the fact that the king himself wouldn't subscribe the Solemn League and Covenant. Okay, and that becomes clear later on. It's maybe not clear from the little list there, but in fact, he was not going to subscribe it himself. And so they would have been back pretty much, you know, it's a little hard to say what would have happened, right? You know, that's one of the great what-ifs of history. But it does seem likely that they would have ended up in nearly the same place as they started, the Scots. I mean, they would have pretty much washed out the idea of reforming the church in England and Ireland, and they would have maybe a little better guarantee, but I mean, what, you know, we're not sure how, his word was never very good anyway, so. Mike, you had a question?
It seems, you know, to think the king was going to do that, obviously, there's a money trail here someplace. Who was getting paid off?
They didn't use money in the 1600s.
The Lord, somebody's benefiting. Otherwise, you know, to think such ridiculous things, obviously. I mean, even Christians, I think, are ridiculous. But follow that.
Well, yeah. I know some people say follow the money, but in this case, it looks to me more like a power type thing. The engagers wanted power. They wanted a Scots king.
It's a political bug.
Yeah. There's some other things going on in England, and I guess we'll get to that in a minute, that aren't very promising. Although this may have sped them along, as it turns out, so. Let's see, we'll get to in England in a minute. So, okay, after they negotiated this treaty, the Convention of States met in Edinburgh on the 2nd of March, 1648, sorry. And after quite a bit of debate, Convention of States approved the engagement. Now, in terms of the actual debate, you know, you might imagine that there was the Parliament or the Convention of States meeting, and without any input from the Church. But in fact, Robert Bailey specifically mentions betwixt the Chancellor, Duke, like I said, be the Duke of Hamilton, Argyll, the Treasurer, Lauderdale, Lanark, Balmerino, Warriston, Mr. Robert Douglas, Mr. George Gillespie, Mr. David Calderwood, Mr. Robert Blair, Mr. David Dixon, Mr. Samuel Rutherford. Many meetings have been had, night and day, private and public, but as yet our discords increase and are ready to break out in a fearful rupture both of church and state. That's what happened. But, you know, as he says, there are many meetings day and night. At times, I think they might have been a little closer to some kind of agreement, but in the end, they could never agree. So in June of 1648, they passed acts which approved the engagement, started putting the country back on a war footing. Okay, and the Committee of Estates also required all subjects to swear an oath to the engagement. So, and it was strongly resisted by the say the radical party of the church, Gillespie, Rutherford, you know, Calderwood, etc. And it was condemned by a General Assembly meeting in July of 1648. George Gillespie moderated the meeting. I guess Gillespie and Bailey are two people I would have liked to have done biographies of, but they're both ministers in the church. Gillespie's died at a very young age. I don't remember exactly how old he was, around 30 or something on that order. but had written a number of influential books. And Robert Bailey was, Gillespie was one of the Westminster commissioners. Robert Bailey was another one, and he was, among other things, principal of the University of Glasgow. He was a minister in, I think, Kilwinning. And but he's, I think, best known today for having written, he wrote all these letters at the time and kept copies of his letters. And there's three volumes of letters. This is one volume right here, the third volume. And it actually, in terms of a source for the history of the time, there's very few things like it. He's later one of the commissioners who meets with Charles II in Holland, and you know, he writes these letters back about what all the, you know, the discussions were and what the king said to him, and so, you know, so on. So all these sorts of things. Okay, let's see. At the same meeting where they formally condemned the engagement, they also approved the Westminster Larger and Shorter Catechisms. And Bailey describes the church's opposition. I have that back, Dave. Let's see. Just read a little bit of this. We are to intimate that this present engagement, as it is stated in the Parliament's declaration, is holden by the Kirk to be unlawful upon these three grounds especially. That the end of it is to bring the king to London with honor, freedom, and safety, without so much as craving from him any security for religion, though he still declares himself as much for episcopacy and averse from our covenant as ever. 2, because all the malignants in England and Ireland are permitted to rise in as many armies as they can, and we can refuse to take them as before for enemies, except they profess to oppose us with the covenant. This quickly makes our former enemies our masters. 3, the managing of this war is put in the hands principally of these men, whose bygone life and known professions declare they mind not religion, and they who have hitherto in our bygone troubles been most eminent instruments of God in the country for the advancement of the work of religion and the liberty of the land are shuffled by, and all power plucked out of their hands. These and many more reasons make us, who were most cordial for a war against the sectaries of England and their adherents, for the vindication of our covenant, for the deliverance of our oppressed brethren in England, for the rescuing of our king from his unjust imprisonment, and restoring of him to the exercise of his royal power, upon his performance of these necessary duties which the parliaments of both kingdoms did require from him, and for the preservation of our church and state from the violence of that evil faction of sectaries, whose principles drive at the averting of the foundations of all government, both of church and state, of the whole isle. We are hindered, notwithstanding, that we cannot join in the present engagement, which is said to be against them, since it's evident that the course now taken is either not truly against them, but will tend to their establishment, as many fear, or else for setting up in their place our former enemies, for the overthrow of all we have been doing these 11 years. So in our judgment, none who will seriously mind religion and good conscience will join either in person, goods, or counsel in this undertaking, and if by violence they be drawn to give any assistance, they must be content presently to suffer what may be put upon them, rather than to act anything that may promote that which they may, which they esteem unlawful. This version was done in the 1800s, but he kept all the old spellings and the F's for S's and so on. So. Okay, so besides the opposition to the way the engagement breaks the solemn league and covenant, we see strong opposition to the army containing malignants, right? Presumably Catholics and Episcopalians, anti-covenanters and notorious sinners. That becomes sort of a motif later on, or not too later on, very shortly. And we also see this whole thing about the business being against the sectaries, right? And that would be all the independents who wanted not to have a state church, Oliver Cromwell being, you know, one of the main ones. And this comes to head very shortly. We'll get to it in just a few minutes. Or what was going on in England at the time. But you can see there's reasons why they were willing to go to war against the sectaries. Okay, while the General Assembly was meeting, the Duke of Hamilton crossed the border with an army of 10,500 infantry and cavalry. He was joined by 36 English soldiers, who were apparently leftover royalists. Cromwell led an army of 8,000, and right, so it was a smaller army, but they soundly defeated the Engager army on the 17th to the 20th of August, 1648, at Preston Moor on the River Ribble. It was one of these things where I think, if I remember right, in this battle, the Hamilton allowed his troops to get separated, and so Cromwell sort of take one group at a time on. And anyways, so he's quite successful, and the 10,000 prisoners, a number of them were sent to plantations as slaves or to Venice as soldiers. So when the news of this defeat reached Edinburgh, Argyle, who had opposed the engagement, he was one of the 9 or 10, and his supporters formed a new government. And they, were joined by a group of Covenanters from the Western Lowlands led by Lord Eglinton. And they marched to Edinburgh and seized the castle in the so-called Whigamore's Raid. Okay, so this established a new government led by Argyle, the one that would negotiate with Charles II for his return. Cromwell then proceeded on to Edinburgh and arrived on the 4th of October. But since he defeated the Engager army, now there was a new government. He was on reasonably good terms initially. That would soon change, but... at that time, they were still standing for continuing solidarity with the English Parliament. So, okay, we have to step over back to England for a little bit. The in England, the English Parliament passed an ordinance to establish Presbyterianism on the 29th of August. However, it was never to amount to much, possibly because there was a change of power in Parliament, as we'll see. Representatives of the English Parliament met with Charles. And they were trying to arrange some reconciliation on the basis of religious settlement along the lines of the Solemn League and Covenant. In other words, a Presbyterian church government in England, so on. And so, at this point, there was still a fairly large Presbyterian party in the English Parliament. Charles refused to reach an acceptable settlement. He refused to subscribe the Solemn League and Covenant. He was still hopeful for military aid from France. The commissioners from the Parliament were kind of in a hurry because they feared a military takeover, which did happen. Charles offered to set up what he called primitive episcopacy. That's where there'd be bishops, but they would be advised by presbyters. But Parliament turned that down on the 27th of October. And by the 6th of December, it was too late. Okay, Cromwell was still in the north. Cromwell's son-in-law, Henry Ireton, basically took over the Parliament by... he had a Colonel Thomas Pride purge the Parliament. He did this by basically standing guard at the Parliament doors and only letting certain members in. Turned away 200, something like 200, leaving less than 150 or something like that. A significant part of the Parliament was turned away. When they complained, they were tossed in jail or locked up somewhere in a tavern or something. So, could be worse.
It could be worse. All right, I'll go. I'll go peaceably.
Okay, it was basically a military coup d'etat, although it retained sort of a, I guess you could say it retained a, I would say a constitutional veneer, although that's not quite right, but it retained a veneer. I mean, there was still the Parliament there. They didn't get rid of Parliament. They later got rid of the House of Lords. So, okay, the remaining 150 members were called, it's called the Rump Parliament, for just the small remainder of the Parliament. They set up a High Court of Justice with 150 commissioners, I don't know if it's the same as the 150 members of Parliament or not, but Cromwell was one of the commissioners. Cromwell told his fellow commissioners, "I tell you, we will cut off the king's head with the crown on it." That's what they did. The trial was opened on the 21st of January, 1649, and by the 30th, Charles had been convicted and executed, his head being removed by a single blow of the axe. So, yeah. It could be worse. Yeah. Okay. Well, the Scottish Parliament met in January 1649 also. They repealed the acts that approved of the engagement, and they protested against the proceedings of the sectaries in England against the king's person. I mean, by that time, of course, the fact that there was going to be a trial and so on, they knew what was going on. They passed what was known as the Act of Classes. Okay, and according to James King Hewison, the author of this two-volume book, The Covenanters, History of the Church in Scotland from the Reformation to the Revolution, he says that evilly conceived statute did more than anything else to embitter Scottish life and to engender hatreds and revenges which the engagers or their children indulged in after the Restoration. Many of those who sat on the stool of repentance lived to harass and destroy the Covenanters. Now, you don't need to take that position as, you know, the gospel truth, as it were, but I do think that later on, that, you know, I mean, what he said was true, that it did embitter Scottish life, and there was a lot of things that went on later were basically revenge driven by this. That's one of the reasons why the engagement is so important, because you see a lot of things that happen are a reaction to it and then a counter-reaction and so on. It divided offenders into four categories with a range of penalties. The worst offenders would be those officers and public servants who had actively promoted the engagement or had plotted against the covenant. They were disbarred from they weren't disbarred from life. They were disbarred from public service for life. Interestingly enough, of course, one of these would have been the Duke of, or this Lauderdale guy, right? So, I mean, later on, he does go on to persecute the Covenanters, and he doesn't end up being disbarred for life. The second class were malignants who had interfered with the opponents of the engagement. They were disbarred for 10 years. The third class were, quote, lukewarm neutrals who had not protested the engagement. They were disbarred for 5 years. And the fourth class were those who had fallen into some type of sin. Uncleanness, bribery, swearing, drunkenness, profanity, and neglect of worship, they were disbarred for a year. Not only were they disbarred from public office for a year, they were also had to publicly confess the sin of joining the engagers, and they weren't permitted to give or receive church privileges until their repentance was noted or was proved. Be interesting question what the right thing to do in such a situation is, but I think you can see where, at the least, that later on this did, you know, I mean, certainly there were a lot of hard feelings. I mean, people were either tossed out of government, or, I mean, certainly some people lost their jobs that were, I'm presuming lower level public servants and so on. So, but apparently, that, I mean, one thing that this had done is just put a lot of people in a situation that was very unpleasant. So, okay, on a somewhat higher note, this Parliament also abolished church patronage. And that was the practice of having a local lord or whoever decide who was the minister was going to be. And the following General Assembly drew up a directory of election which gave each congregation the right to choose a pastor, with the selection confirmed by the Kirk Session and the Presbytery. While Parliament was still in session, news reached Edinburgh of the execution of Charles I. And you can now see there's sort of maybe three parties of interest here. There's the Royalists and the Malignants, and there's the Covenanters, Presbyterians, and then there's the Sectaries. And the Sectaries had gone out and done this, and they'd done it, I think you could probably contend that they also violated the Solemn League and Covenant. They took matters into their own, into their own hands, and they got rid of the Presbyterian Party, and then they went off and killed the king. And as bad a king as he was, this was the English Parliament, and he was also the King of Scotland. So, the Scots were highly offended at this.
Did Cromwell lose support in England for it as well?
There were.
It seems like it was an awfully rash thing to do.
There was a lot of. It was not a very popular act. I mean, a lot of people were absolutely shocked that it came to this. Even people who'd been like in the military, like Fairfax, had been leader of the Parliamentary Army. He sat out on this Court of High Commission and stayed away. So his wife came though and yelled epithets. It was pretty interesting. So, a lot of people, people who'd been on the parliamentary side, certainly the Presbyterian Party, didn't favor executing the king.
It just sounds like, coup d'etat, or at least a consolidation of power.
That's what it was. I mean, they got rid of all the people that weren't like-minded enough.
Then
they killed the king. Well, for a while, yeah. Let's see. So on the 5th of February, the Parliament proclaimed Charles II King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland. I was hoping to get Dr. Reeves to explain this business about being King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I've always assumed, that it was wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they didn't seem to get mad when the English Parliament executed their Charles. According to Hewison, this proclamation expressed the almost universal protest of the Scots against what they styled the murder of the king. In other words, it shouldn't be taken just to be, a few members of Parliament who were mad and everybody else was thrilled. I mean, they were quite unhappy in general. I think a lot of us, it boggles our mind to see how the Covenanters support the king and then support Charles II and so on. But even if it's not completely understandable, it was widespread. So, okay. Now, the proclamation of Charles II as king was not unconditional. In fact, Parliament had made it conditional by an act of Parliament on him accepting the two covenants, the National Covenant and the Solemn League Covenant, all the Westminster Standards, Presbyterian Church government, and that he removed from his presence Montrose. Okay? Montrose had fled to the continent after his loss at Philippa, and he eventually found his way to the court in exile of Charles II in Holland. And Montrose was hopping mad that they'd killed the king, and he blamed the Covenanters for it. So it's kind of interesting. He put out a number of proclamations after that, and I always thought, it's a bit strange that it was just seemed like propaganda. But anyways, and in fact, it's pretty interesting. In this book, in the Bailey book, in addition to his letters at the back, there's a number of other documents, and they actually have the instructions to the commissioners, both the commissioners of the church that represented the church. Well, they sent a commission to see the king. It was representatives both of the church and of the Parliament, the estates. And they actually, there's specific directions in there, but we're jumping ahead here, so we'll. Okay, the General Assembly immediately sent a letter to the king craving him to avoid both malignants and sectaries, to establish Presbyterianism, to enjoin the covenants, and to promote uniformity in all his dominions. Parliament and the church then sent this commission. They, representing Parliament included the Earl of Cassilis, George Winram of Liberton, and Alexander Brodie of Brodie. The latter two were later to become, Supreme Court justices or something, judges of the Supreme Court in Scotland. When they got there, they arrived on the 27th of March, 1649. Cassilis made a speech on behalf of the Parliament, Bailey made one on behalf of the Church. And there's this speech in here, and it's not too long, and it basically expresses their desire that the king will subscribe the covenants. It'll stay away from sectaries and malignants and so on. Hewison tells us that these ambassadors arrived too late to shape the policy of a young and inexperienced king, then angrily bent on avenging his father's death and seizing the throne by force. He'd already appointed Montrose as his governor of Scotland. I should think they were about 18 years too late. Okay, Charles II was 18 at the time. Besides being an angry young man, he was rather dissolute. He was already on his way to, to a rather prodigious output of illegitimate children, or bastards, as I have in my notes here. I counted one footnote of the children that he owned, that he said, admitted to, that grew to be adults. There were 12 of them with 8 different mothers. So, anyways, that's why I think I think Dave's pointed out before that your behavior often influences your theology. Is that, if you lead a dissolute life, you're not going to say, oh, well, I really like Presbyterianism. But, so. Okay. So, there's a, Hewison describes Charles's character, I think, in other details. And, let's see.
Yeah. Where was he at this point? Was he in France?
He'd been in the island of Jersey, and he was in Holland at this time.
Had he been banished there? Or did he flee there? Or why?
Well, he...
was he just there on holiday, or what?
Well, I'm not really sure exactly. I know his Charles's wife had left the country. I'm not sure about Charles II. But I'm guessing he was probably left the country early on because he was the heir to the throne. I really don't know for sure, but he was on the Isle of Jersey, which is in the English Channel, close to France, right, Simon?
Yeah.
And then he went from there to went from there to Holland, so, and had sort of a court in exile. Actually went back and forth several times, right in the time right around when Charles I was executed. Okay, it says, Charles inherited the fixed idea of the Stuart kings regarding their divinely appointed dynastic superiority. Thus, possessed of a definite aim, boyishly enthusiastic over the Herculean capabilities of Montrose, and encouraged in his resentment against the stiff-necked, rebellious Covenanters, by exiled English royalists and Scottish engagers, refugees from parliamentary vengeance and the draconian discipline of the church, Charles was not a youth likely to be biased by the arguments of the deputies from the Argyll government. Besides, they had most unpalatable counsels to offer, being authorized to ban popery, prelacy, and malignancy, to inform Charles that his popish mother's idolatry was the main cause of the evils in Britain, to advise him to avoid a popish sweetheart, and to order him to dismiss that unhappy and cursed man, James Graham. That was Montrose. In Scotland, this was the traditional method of dealing with kings by aggressive agitators who usually had some inkling of latent intrigues which long afterwards were exposed. They began by cursing and ended with a petition for a blessing. The staunchest Covenanters displayed discrimination in distrusting Charles from the beginning. Time developed him in his true colors as a man who concealed his lack of virtue, principle, and grace by plausible manners, courteous acts done for expediency, and pleasant promises made to be broken if convenient. He inherited his father's genius for dissimulation and his grandfather's inability to understand that subjects had rights as well as rulers.
Picked up all their bad
traits. Yeah. Picked up all their bad traits. Now, there's also some discussion, possibly he was already, had been, converted to Catholicism and so on, but I think he's pretty much a man whose religion served whatever ends that he found useful, so I wouldn't put too much stock in it one way or another that he was secretly converted to Catholicism. If it was, it was just a matter of expedience. Okay, after a fair amount of negotiation, he gave a guardedly favorable reply to the Scottish commissioners. He would swear the covenant. He would maintain the Scottish Church as Presbyterian. Liar. However, he wouldn't accept Presbyterianism for England. So, the Scottish commissioners returned to Scotland on the 27th of May. They'd failed to get complete acquiescence in their demands at that point. But even the acquiescence that they did get was really worthless. But they came back, and then there was a series of negotiations. But let me show you a contemporary cartoon. It's on the back cover here, but it's a little clearer right here. It shows the Scots. This is a jockey, a Scot here, and this is apparently a Scottish minister, I'm guessing, with a robe and a black hat. And here's Charles, and they've got a grindstone, and they're pushing his nose into the grindstone. It says, "The Scots holding their young king's nose to ye grindstone." It's a little hard to read the blur, but it says something like the... come to the grindstone, Charles. It's now too late, or something, to recollect his Presbyterian fate. Anyways, you can see that, but basically, you get the idea that they're that the commissioners are there and they're holding the king's nose to the grindstone. So, okay, Bailey was one of the commissioners appointed. He gives some accounts of the meetings with the king, including, there's actually quite a few details here, but I want to quote a couple parts. This is from his first letter to Mr. Robert Douglas. And he expresses reading the letters, he expresses concern. Basically, the king has bad counselors. "It were verily a great pity of the king. He is one of the most gentle, innocent, well-inclined princes, so far as yet appears, that lives in the world. A trim person and of a manly carriage, understands pretty well, speaks not much. Would God he were amongst us." And then in a second letter, written a couple weeks later, he talks about how he... Well, the king had given him a long and very favorable audience from 10 at night till near 11. And he couldn't send the contents of this conference because there was an English man of war near the Brile that searches all letters, comes from this. As yet, we cannot get it helped. So in other words, their letters were subject to being seized and read. So, but then he goes on to say, "In this conference I found the king, in my judgment, of a very meek and equitable disposition, understanding and judicious enough, though firm to the tenets his education and company has planted in him. If God would send him among us without some of his present counselors, I think he might make, by God's blessing, as good a king as Britain saw these 100 years. And he goes on to explaining what the issues are, finding the great stick to be upon the League and Covenant, his own taking it, and assuring to pass it for England and Ireland, of his persuasion that his passing all the Acts of Parliament, passed or to be passed in Scotland, for taking of it there would be satisfactory. I strove by many reasons to show the unsatisfactoriness of such a concession." And... anyways, there's quite a bit here about how he goes back and forth with the king, but you can see from his letters he has a sort of assume the best about the king naivete, and I think some of the other covenanters, as Hewison points out, were a little smarter than Probably they're a little more judicial than Bailey.
So they didn't have much to go on.
No, they didn't have much to go on. And he apparently was, you know, did have very good manners when he wanted to, and lied convincingly and so on. Okay. The king, though, wasn't satisfied just to negotiate with the Argyle government. He also sent Montrose to begin a war there. Timetable's a little unclear. It's somewhat important because and I was reading this book by Antonia Fraser, who may recall also wrote a biography of Mary Queen of Scots. This is her biography of Charles II. She claims that Montrose was basically out of touch. He was already in Scotland and didn't know what the king was. You know, the king couldn't reach him, but that doesn't really seem to be quite the case. Maybe later that he was out of touch, but he didn't actually arrive in Scotland until March of 1650, and he was basically going around Scandinavia and so on, collecting mercenaries. But he made a number of declarations. He accused the Covenanters of unsettling religion, gendering errors, subverting law, selling and murdering the king. In November 1649, he called on those who supported the king to join him in opposing a horrid faction of rebels, the Covenanters. So Charles was on the one hand negotiating with the Covenanters, and on the other hand, he was beginning this military campaign. This continued through 1649. In September, Charles wrote to Montrose to go on vigorously. The Covenanters set a negotiating party in October 1649 to the king. In January 1650, Charles invited the Covenanters to continue negotiations. He wrote Montrose not to worry about what he was discussing with the Covenanters. He should, as Montrose should, proceed on your business with your usual courage and alacrity. So don't worry that I'm negotiating with the Covenanters. He also sent him the Order of the Garter on this occasion. And one historian pointed out this was one of the few cases where a stab in the back was softened by awarding the Order of the Garter. In March of 1650, another party of Scottish commissioners arrived in Holland. Montrose arrived in Scotland at the same time, so things were all overlapped and going out at the same time. On the 27th of April, Montrose's army was met and defeated by an army led by Lieutenant Colonel Strachan. And Strachan is said here to be an old trooper of the Model Army who had fought with Cromwell against Hamilton, was a lewd and scandalous fellow whose half-conversion by Blair and James Guthrie gave him entrance from sectarian into covenanting councils, which Bailey thought he did not improve. One thing good about Bailey is that he often gives his opinion about people on it, or things that people have done, you know. So Montrose escaped, but he was captured after 4 days, sick and hungry. He was marched back to Edinburgh, where he was executed on the 21st of May 1650, having already been found guilty of treason some years before. Montrose is, he's really an interesting character. He's like Hewison speak highly of him in some regards. I think he was mistaken when he decided to take up the king's cause, but he was apparently an honorable man, wasn't a notorious sinner or anything like that. Apparently also had certainly was very brave and had a fair stroke of the romantic about him, and you know, he was ready to give his life for the king. Under different circumstances, he might have been a great leader, but under these circumstances, he got his head cut off. So, and it's said that the Earl of Strafford haunted Charles I. Charles I had promised he'd always protect this guy, and then he let him be executed by Parliament. And it said as Earl of Strafford haunted Charles the First. Montrose haunted Charles the Second. Charles wrote the Parliament a letter saying he was sorry that Montrose had invaded the kingdom in spite of Charles' demand that he not do so. Charles earnestly desires the States of Parliament to do himself that justice as not to believe that he was accessory to the said invasion in the least degree. Okay, well, the negotiations between Charles and the Scottish government went back and forth. He eventually agreed to subscribe the National Covenant and the Solemn League Covenant, despite his beliefs. On 3rd of July 1650, while still on board ship, he was coming over to Scotland, anchored in the mouth of the River Spey. He took an oath that went beyond the Solemn League and Covenant. It starts, "I, Charles, King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, do assure and declare by my solemn oath, in the presence of Almighty God, the Searcher of all hearts, my allowance and approbation of the National Covenant and Solemn League and Covenant above written." Then referring to Presbyterian worship, "and I shall observe these in my own practice and family, and shall never make any opposition to any of these, nor endeavor any alteration therein." Well, pretty clearly Charles just said whatever was convenient at the time and said it in a way to try to convince people. One of the commissioners that had met with him, Alexander Jaffrey, later wrote that, "We did both sinfully entangle and engage the nation ourselves in that poor young prince to whom we were sent, making him sign and swear a covenant which we knew from clear and demonstrable reasons that he hated in his heart." And it seems to be a pretty safe conclusion that they, you know, they probably knew he hated in his heart, but somehow thought that if they had just got him to sign on the dotted line and then
walk the aisle,
that he would then toe the line, to mix metaphors. So, okay, we'll stop there. And any questions or discussion? Dave?
How much intelligence would the Covenanters had while they were negotiating and working with Montrose, realizing the king was also assembling forces against them?
Oh, they would have known it, because among other things, it wouldn't have taken much intelligence, because Montrose was issuing public declarations, not himself, but I mean written declarations, to ask all those who, you know, who approved of the king. I mean,
it wasn't a very covert operation.
No. I mean, him initially arriving in Scotland might have been covert, but it wasn't a covert operation. And I mean, some people say that basically the king was sort of negotiating with the covenanters, you know, sort of with a carrot and a stick, you know, with the stick being Montrose. So, and also that he was, he had sort of plan A and plan B, you know, and the best plan A would be for Montrose to be victorious.
Right.
So. But, you know, if that didn't work out, then he could always, you know, lie about the covenants and so on. So,
were all these armies pretty much ragtag militias? I mean, were there any trained soldiers in these armies? Or did Montrose just show up and try to drum up some support?
Well, I think he had some trained men, but no, a lot of them were probably what you might call ragtag militia. If I remember right, Strachan basically, he had a body of cavalry. Montrose had no cavalry. And he landed in the far north part of Scotland, so you know, it was Highlanders, probably hadn't seen much of the world. And he had, Strachan actually hit his cavalry, held them back. So they started this battle on foot, and then he had the cavalry charge in, and a bunch of Montrose's troops just, you know, ran. So, some of these outcomes might be humanly attributable to that, but you know, you see a lot of these battles, and you can only think, well, God ordained that it would come out this way. I mean, you know, large armies, Cromwell defeating smaller, you know, with his smaller force defeating these larger armies. Now Cromwell interpreted it as God's, you know, good favor on him, you know, that you know that was why he was winning these battles.
There almost seems to be a desire in Scotland at the time for the necessary order of having a king and going through the proper routine of making sure he subscribes to the attending covenants and documents, but not really discounting, after their recent history, all the potential danger that political power brings with it and the destruction and abuse of the church.
Yeah,
at one point, I mean, obviously they had their king had been executed and they didn't like it. But one almost wonders why they didn't abandon the whole idea at the time.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, they had, of course, they had spent a lot, and I don't know I can't give you a definitive answer, but they had spent a lot of time and intellectual energy trying to show, say, Charles I that Presbyterianism was not opposed to monarchy, which I believe is true. Of course, Charles thought it was. But certainly they'd spent a lot of intellectual energy trying to show that. The idea that anyone would execute a king, you know, and start a form of republic was a very revolutionary idea at this time. You know, so it's a little hard for us to step back into a 17th century mindset and understand why they would have felt so strongly that they needed a king. But it does seem to be sort of the default mode of operation. And the way things had gone, where the sectaries had taken over in England, which they weren't happy about, and seemed to reflect a lot on, you know, and say, well, okay, this is what happened, but maybe this isn't so bad. We can live as a republic. And they also had this, I guess you could say, this grand vision of this three covenanted countries, in England, Ireland, and Scotland. And they weren't willing to see that dream sort of disappear. They had this, you know, grand vision, and now Parliament had, England had really gone back on it. So,
did in the Covenanter thought process, did they have did they see themselves in prophecy or anything like that? I mean, usually people act the way they do because of the religion that they have. Yeah. This idea of being,
I thought they acted that way because of the money. It may be the religion they have.
Doing things like that, seeing that they obviously they have something like post-millennial thought in the fact that, you know, Christ's kingdom, they're going to bring it to pass on earth, correct?
Yeah.
That would have been part of it.
Yeah, they, there was very clearly a, at least certainly in Rutherford, a post-millennial thought process that thought that God was setting up his kingdom in Scotland as, you know, the purest nation in the world and so on. And so I don't know in terms of whether you could say that they, that many of them thought there was some specific biblical prophecy. I haven't seen that ever. That, you know, that they somehow interpreted something to mean,
they didn't have a Helen,
right, you know, that showed
widely public.
Yeah, they I've never seen anything like that, but I think you definitely see this general trend towards the post-millennial vision being applied to Scotland, and thinking that they could sort of set up this, you know, kingdom in a way that would be in tune with the final post-millennial outcome. So in one respect, you might say, well, you know, perhaps there were men who were just ahead of their time, and they were trying to bring the kingdom of God in with violence to some degree. I mean, they would say they weren't trying to do that, but But, you know, I mean, later they would go to war. I mean, they sometimes consciously said, no, we're not trying to force anyone, you know, with the sword to go along. But they were willing to use the... Certainly were willing to go to war to to further their ends. But, so... Oh, now I see who's causing all the noise out there. Okay, well, why don't we stop there and let's see. Dan, would you close us in prayer?